but that's good. Okay, be opening your Bibles, if you would, to John chapter 4. Last week, we went back to the background of the Samaritan woman. Went way back to the close of the Old Testament and came through. Saw how that there were two temples that were built, one in Jerusalem, one on Mount Gerizim in Samaria. And then John chapter 4 opens up, and Jesus, the Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining more disciples than John was, and they already had lots of problems with John's ministry and people following him. By the way, Bert, we're glad to have you out of the hospital here with us. You are too. We're glad. That's the answer to prayers. And so, having already had problem with John and his disciples, whenever Jesus realized that the Pharisees were talking about the fact that he was gaining more disciples than John, he knew that they were going to have to address him. And so, we know that Jesus wasn't afraid of a confrontation with them. But the confrontation wasn't time yet. And so he moved from there to Galilee and started what we would call his major Galilean ministry. And on the way, when you travel from Judea to Galilee, then you pass through Samaria. Samaria is both a district and a town. There's both. There's an area named Samaria, there is a town named Samaria. He was in the region of Samaria, and he came to a plot of ground that Joseph had given his son Jacob. Jacob had given his son Joseph, and he had dug a well there, and that well was still there, still in use. And so he sat down by the well. There was a city nearby named Sychar. There, that well was at the foot of a mountain, Mount Gerizim, and on the top of Mount Gerizim was the Samaritan temple. So, in view of that well where he had sat down was a temple, Samaritan temple on top of that hill. That temple, we went back and saw when it came into existence and why it came into existence, and the fact that they also had a priesthood that was of the Levitical descent. They had their own Bible, the Samaritan Pentateuch, and so they had their own denomination here. They had their own religion, and it had been there for a long, long time. And the people of that region were as convinced that Samaria was a place to worship as the Jews were that Jerusalem was a place to worship. And so you had two temples, two priesthood, two rival religions here. And that had been an ongoing, raging debate for generations and generations and generations. Where's the right place to worship? Should you go to Jerusalem? Should you go to Samaria, to the temple there? And so it is against that background that Jesus goes through Samaria. He sits down at Jacob's well. He tells his disciples to go into Sychar and buy some food and come back. So he's sitting there by himself. He's tired. He's had about three really, really hard days. He's worn out, and he's there resting by that well and by himself, and a woman approaches, a woman from that area, a Samaritan woman. And so awkwardness is. We talked about if you ever get on an elevator and there's someone there, and particularly if it's someone distinctly different from you, then there's just this awkward silence, and you hope that this thing hurry up and get to the fourth floor so one of you can get off, you know. And there's this awkwardness. And so Jesus doesn't feel that awkwardness. And that's pretty neat, I think. And he says to the woman when she gets there and she starts making preparation to draw from this well, and the water is about 135 feet down. So it takes a long rope and, you know, some effort to get that up. And so he looks at her and he said, "Would you give me a drink of water?" She's shocked. And she said, "How is it that you would ask a drink from me, a woman, a Samaritan, and you are a Jew?" And then she made the statement, and I thought it's kind of funny, the word that's used. She says, "For Jews do not," and the NIV says, "associate with Samaritans." The word is use together. U-S-E, use together with Samaritans. And that has led some translators to say that what she said was, Jews won't drink out of the same thing that Samaritans drink out of. They won't use the utensils that we use. And so, it was something that was obvious to both of them. And Jesus responded. He's asked her for a drink. She has shown surprise that he would ask her for a drink. And he said, "Ma'am, if you knew what God had to offer, and if you knew who you were talking to, you would ask me, and I would give you living water." Well, he piques her curiosity. And so she comes up immediately with two objections to that. Number one, she said, "Sir, you don't have a rope. How are you going to get water from there? The well is deep, and how are you going to get that water for me and give me a drink? And besides that, are you greater than our father Jacob, who is the one who dug this well, and he himself drank from it, and his sons drank from it? Are you greater than he is?" And Jesus said, "Yep." Now, he said it in more words than that, didn't he? But he did go on to show, "Yes, I am greater, because anybody who drinks from this well is going to get thirsty again, and anybody who drinks the water that I give them will never get thirsty again." Well, she's all about that. I mean, this pot that she brought out here is most certain. They didn't have plastic back then. And so the pot was very likely a heavy pot to start with. Water weighs eight pounds a gallon. And so, if this was 3-gallon jar, and why would you make this trip out from the city and not come back with, a fair amount of water? So if she got 3 gallons, that's 24 pounds plus whatever the jar weighs. So this is a pretty good trek. And you can be assured one thing, it's either uphill or downhill, one way or the other, isn't it? And so he's really piqued her interest. And she now says, "Sir, give me a drink of water. Give me this water so that I won't get thirsty again." So he's flipped the tables, hasn't he? He started out asking her. Now she's asking him. So he has accomplished something. He has caused her to feel a need for something that he says he can provide. And so now that she's asked for that, he says, "Go get your husband." He's going to deepen this. He's going to add something to this need. What's he going to add? He's going to add the guilt of sin to it. "Go get your husband." "I don't have a husband." All of a sudden, she's not so talky anymore. "I don't have a husband." "Yeah, that's right. You've had 5 of them, and now the guy you're living with, you're just shacked up with him." Wow. Now, he really has her attention. And besides having created a need, now he has added to that a sense of guilt. By the way, in order to receive the gospel, guess what you got to know? You got to know that God has something to offer you that you really need, and you got to know why you need it. And you really have to feel a sense of need. She had felt a sense of need for that water from a purely physical standpoint. That's all she saw. But now he's taking that need much deeper. And he's causing her to realize that she has a much deeper need than just the physical need that she's feeling. That's what has to happen in order for a person to be truly converted. You have to know, not that just he can supply your physical needs. If you stop there, then you're just like anybody else. But that he can supply the really deep need in your life. And you have to know what that need is, and most people don't. Most of us don't. And the truth is, if we're given a choice, we don't want to know. Because this causes us to introspect and search our souls, and that's a really uncomfortable thing to have to do. But anyway, they've come here now to the point that she has decided in verse 19 that he's a prophet. And when she decides that, and she's going to run into town and say, hey, I want you to come see this guy who told me everything that I ever did. He knows everything about me. He's a prophet. And he might be the Messiah. But we'll hit that a little bit later. Right now, we're at that level where she has this sense, this consciousness of sin. And she says, and she's decided he's a prophet, she says, sir, I perceive you're a prophet. And now, with that, she's going to revert to what we spent all last week setting the stage for. She's going to revert to that age-old question that's been raging between the Jews and Samaritans about what? Where is the proper place to worship? Where's the proper place to worship? Is it in Samaria? She said, your fathers say you worship in Jerusalem. My fathers say that we worship here in this mountain, right up there, in this place. And so that sets the stage for what I want to say. You see, Jesus, her concept of worship is an institutional concept. It's tied to a place and a time, certain acts. It's a physical thing. And she thinks you've got to get to the right place to worship. So we're going to address the place first, Jesus is. And now, in verse 20, Jesus says, our fathers worshiped in this mountain, but she says, but you Jews claim the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. In verse 21, Jesus declared, believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. Now, we're going to dissect this one statement at a time. And there, it's all going to build on each other. And I want us to concentrate on that statement, that just take this little bite. It may not be so little, but take this bite that Jesus just said, that the time is coming when you're not going to worship in Jerusalem, you're not going to worship in this mountain. So, this is, when he says, a time is coming, what does that denote to you? Not there yet. Something that's coming is going to be different from what has been, right? I mean, can we all agree that he's saying a time is coming when, you know, it's not going to be here, it's not going to be at Jerusalem? And specifically now we're talking about the right place to do worship. So he's saying from the very outset, a time is coming when all of this is going to change. All of this what? All of this going to a special place to worship is going to change. It's neither going to be in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. And see, I think that we have taken this concept and we've understood that. We've understood, okay, worship today, the New Testament concept of worship today, is not that we have to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and we don't have to make one to Mount Sychar, do we? And we've even taken a step further than that, and we've said, we've broadened our concept of worship out to understand that it doesn't take place in Jerusalem or Samaria or any other place. Any other place. We're talking about the place. But I'm saying to us, I think we've grown some. We talked about when we were working on Romans and we went to James and we found out what true faith was. We talked about the fact that we make a step and then we make another step. And sometimes we fall, we make a step, we understand something, and that's where we stop when we need to make another step. And I'm suggesting to you that the purpose of this study is I think we need to make a step beyond what we have traditionally understood here. We understand that it's not at a particular place, not at any place, no longer in Jerusalem or Samaria or any other place. There is a change in systems. There is no more holy place or place of worship. Even though we still have some remnants of that, don't we? We still, you know, on the fringe of our conversation, we still, you know, struggle with going to worship and being at worship and starting worship and ending worship. We still have some of those remnants. Most of us have an understanding that really supersedes what we say, okay? And I'm giving us that much of a benefit of the doubt, that we know that this is not a holy place like the holy place in a temple in Jerusalem, right? We know that, and we preach that, and we talk about that. That, you know, it's not the place that makes the church, right? This is just a place where we assemble. But because we've held on to some things, and again, I'm not trying to make you overly sensitive or super conscious about saying it just exactly the right way. All of that will come with time if you get the understanding right. But even what we call this place, you got to call it something, all right? I'm with you. I understand that. You got to call it something. But even our terminology betrays sometimes what we feel and what we think. But there's a system change. No more holy place. No more place of worship. And let me, again, every so often, I'm just going to throw out where I'm going with all this. And here it is. I'm going to throw it out again. We live in a time when the holy place is your life and everything that you do. That's the holy place. And we're going to take a long time. I throw it out for your consideration. We'll come back and pick up the steps of how we're going to get there. Here's a biggie coming up. You might want to write these down because we're going to refer to what I'm about to say for the rest of this study. There are three things in the Old Testament that constituted acceptable worship. Three things. You had to have a temple in which God dwelled, right? Number two, you had to have a qualified priest. And number three, you had to have an acceptable sacrifice. Those three things comprised acceptable worship. The right place, the right priest, and the right sacrifice. Now, what do you know where we're going? Somebody turn for me and hold it to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19. Who'll get that? Let me see a hand. Tyrone, you got it? Okay, somebody else give me Revelation 1, 5, and 6. Let me see a hand. Okay? Todd? And then Romans chapter 12, verse 1. And if we don't turn to all the others, we're going to turn to that one together. All right? Okay, here's three things that we need for acceptable worship. You need a temple where God dwells. You need a priest who is an acceptable priest from God, qualified priest. And you need an acceptable sacrifice. And not just any place or any priest or any sacrifice will do. It never would, right? God wouldn't accept certain sacrifices, right? He had requirements for sacrifices. He wouldn't accept just anybody as a priest, right? You with me? This is yes, this is no, all right? You with me? Not just anybody could be a priest, all right? And not just any place would do. He told them to go to Jerusalem, and there's where he dwelled, right? His presence was in the Holy of Holies, right? And so you had to have the temple, you had to have the priest, you had to have the sacrifice. Okay, we're going to bring that to today, all right? We're looking for a temple in which God dwells. Okay, Tyrone, you want to read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19? Okay, don't you know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, and you're not your own. You're bought with a price. This is in the context of a reason for a Christian not involving himself in immorality. Because God is living in you, and when you take this body in which God is dwelling, God's Holy Spirit lives, and you join it to a harlot, you're doing something absolutely unthinkable. That God is living in this body, and you take this body and you join it to a harlot, he says. What are you doing? What in the world are you doing? So, when we're looking for the place where God dwells today, God doesn't dwell, Paul will say on Mars Hill, God doesn't dwell in temples made with men's hands. Where does he dwell today? In us as Christians. Okay, we've got one thing that's necessary for worship to take place. We've got a temple where God dwells. What's the next thing we need? We need a priest, don't we? We got the place. We need a priest. Okay, Revelation 1, 5, and 6. Okay, Jesus has made us to be what? Priests. Are you a priest? Are you a priest? You are. Men and women, all Christians, are priests. Now, what's a priest's job? Offer sacrifices, right? Can't do it just anywhere. Got to have the right place. Got to have the temple where God dwells. Okay. I got the temple where God dwells. I got the priest. I need one more thing. I need an acceptable sacrifice. Turn with me to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12. I think I said 1 Corinthians earlier, didn't I? But Romans 12. I want everybody to get there. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer yourselves as living sacrifices, holy, acceptable, or pleasing to God, which is your, what does the NIV say? Spiritual worship. The words, and we're going to spend a couple of lessons on words. Logikos. Lutreo. What word would you think we would get from logikos? Logical or reasonable. And the next word, lutreo, we're going to find out, is worship or service. So here we are. We got a temple where God dwells. We got a priest. And we're looking for a sacrifice. And Romans chapter 12, verse 1 says, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer yourselves as living sacrifices. Holy, we're going to talk about that some more. Holy, it's got to be clean, consecrated, prepared to offer to God as your logikos lutreo, your logical worship. Think about how logical it is. God loved you so much that he sent his son to die on the cross. You want to tell him how much you appreciate that. And so you reach in your back pocket and you pull your wallet out and you grab $100 bill and you put it in the plate and you tell him, that's how thankful I am. Really? Is that the extent of your thankfulness? Have you paid your debt now? You got God off your back? You paid him back for the cross? There's only one logical response to the cross. You know what it is? Here am I. And all that I have is yours. And I'll use it in your service. In everything that I do. Is there anything less than that that you would offer to God? Now think about that. Because if you really accept this and you really believe this, it's going to change your life. There's no more God's money and my money. God's time and my time. There's no more God's time and anything else. There's no more God's money and anything else. It's all His. My time, my energy, my money, my family, my job, my car, the food He gives me, everything. And folks, it makes a really big difference in our life when we get to the point that we honestly acknowledge it's God's. Because we live our life acting like it's mine. It's my body and I'll do what I want to with it. It's my money and I'll do what I want to with it. It's my time and I'll do what I want to with it. And I satisfy God by giving Him this portion right here. Kapunk, here. God, You have this. The rest of it is mine. Really? That's a big lie that Satan tells you. None of it is yours. And none of it is mine. And that little baby right there in arms, guess who that is? That's God's. And He entrusted it to this family. But this baby's His. It makes a difference if you view it that way. And this money you got in your back pocket, it's God's. And if it is, that means that you're going to use it in a way that's going to please God. Or if you want to get down a little bit crasser, you're not going to use any of it in a way that would displease God. You're not going to use it in any way that God Himself wouldn't use it. Now, we're talking about a radical change here in our thinking process. Time is coming when you're not going to worship here, you're not going to worship here. There's going to be a new worship place, new worship time, and a new means of worship. And the place is going to be wherever you are. And the time is going to be 24/7. And what you offer is going to be everything that you have at your disposal. You're going to give it all to Him. Now, folks, when we make that transition in our life and we really understand that, we're understanding what Jesus told this woman at Samaria. We've made some progress with what He said. Whenever He said, we're not going to worship this mountain nor in Jerusalem, then we've said, okay, we don't have to go to those temple places. And we've even, most of us have made the transition and we've said, well, you know, it's not necessarily any particular place in the world. But we really haven't gotten away from the time and what we do. And we come here to worship. And we leave here. Are we not worshiping when we leave here? We've seen signs that some churches have said that says, enter to worship, leave to serve. Now what we're going to find out is that's redundant. I don't mean, I didn't say by that word that it's wrong. I said it is redundant. It is saying the same thing twice. That's what we're going to see when we get into the words. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And to answer your question, yes. And your question was that broad, so I can't just give you a one, you know, the answer to what you say is yes. And we're going to the concern that precipitated this observation is, well, if what you're saying is true, then you're detracting from what we do here and now on Sunday morning. And that's a legitimate concern, by the way. It is a legitimate concern. So here's what I'm saying that I'm not saying. I'm not saying that worship does not take place here. I am saying that worship does not exclusively take place here. I'm not saying that there are not some things that we have been instructed to do on the first day of the week assembly that are not still binding, if you want that word, and it's a perfectly good word. There are some things that are to take place in the first day of the week assembly that make it special, this corporate worship that we have. But I'm also saying if you get the idea that that's your worship and that takes care of your responsibility for worshiping God, then we need to expand your understanding of worship. So again, and I'm going to say this and thank Ian for it's a good time to bring it up because it's the obvious concern that comes up. And you say, well, then if what you're saying is true, I don't need to come to church. I don't need to come to the assembly. That's what comes. And we're going to talk about the purpose of the assembly. We're going to spend a lot of time talking. In fact, we're going to spend most of the rest of the time talking about the purpose of the assembly. Because it comes to our mind, well, if I am worshiping 24/7, then I can tell you about me. I can go out on the creek bank and I can worship pretty good. Because I can get alone with me and God, and I can meditate and I can think about spiritual things in a setting like that I get a lot of benefit from. And I'll say, amen. But I'll also say that doesn't substitute for the responsibility that God's given you for your brothers and sisters to assemble on the first day of the week. And that there are certain things that are to be done on the first day of the week that are not a part of the worship that goes on within your life. Somebody, Tyrone?
Yeah. Well, one person said, you need to take this really good.
Talk as loud as you can. That's right. And it's really, rather than detract from the purpose of this assembly, when you understand this, it even adds purpose to this assembly. Because there are some things that take place in this assembly that can't be accomplished out here on your own. And there are some responsibilities that God has given us and some charges that God has given us that can only be discharged here in this setting, and we're going to see that. So as we progress, and we did this same thing when we were studying through our first 8 chapters of Romans, as we progress, then there are times when I need to stop and assure you not only of what I'm saying but what I'm not saying, because the fear level rises a little bit that this preacher is going to be saying that this is really not, we don't have to come on the first day of the week. And so, understand, I'm not saying that worship does not take place here. Worship does take place here, but not exclusively here. Our concept of worship, to be real honest with you, has been tied to the Jewish system. It really has, more than we know. Because we talk about this place we come to and these 5 acts that we do. And there have been all kind of arguments that have been made about those 5 acts of worship. In fact, it'd be real interesting if I had everybody, without looking on anybody else's paper, write down what those 5 acts are. And we might not all write down the same 5, by the way. We'd get pretty close. We'd get probably 4 pretty close. But when we think about coming to worship, then we've still got some of what Jesus was telling this Samaritan woman, the time is coming when something totally new is coming on the scene. And we made it kind of new. We just didn't make it new like he has made it in the New Testament. The New Testament knows of no place of worship exclusively and divorce from any other place. It knows of a life of worship. And we're going to be looking at our Bibles. Again, I say to you, don't accept it because I say it. That's not good enough. We're going to look at the Bible and see what the Bible has to say about worship. And I want to tell you again, I want to go back and tell you why this is so important and what value this is going to have to you. So many of us have bogged down spiritually, and we've gotten to a certain point in our life spiritually, and we've been sitting right there for a long, long time. And we haven't progressed very much because we have set worship aside in one part of our life. And then we have spiritual and we have secular. We have God's part and then we have everybody else's part. My family's part, my boss's part, my job's part, my wife's part, my part. And all that's of my money and my time and my energy and my resources. And it's all divided up into this pie. And we keep those pieces keep expanding and contracting over the years. And we only have so much resources and time and energy. And so when we take some of it and put it over here, then we've robbed another place over here. Let me tell you one of the practical applications of what we're saying here. I believe that when you, as a Christian father, take some of the money that you've worked for and you take your family on a vacation and you grow close together and you do wholesome things together, you don't go out to nightclub and drink, but you do wholesome things together, I believe you're serving God. I believe you're worshiping God. When you do that. And I believe when a mother has a baby that's got, and you know, I'm just trying to get it down to practicality, that baby's got a dirty diaper, and she's cleaning that baby up, and she's loving that baby as a Christian mother, I believe she's offering that to God as worship. I believe everything you do is worship. And that puts our lives on a different plane, folks. Because we're not going to do anything that God would disapprove of. We can't offer to him the blind and the crippled and the spotted. We can't do that. He won't accept that. The sacrifice has to be holy, acceptable unto God. And when we view our lives that way, it takes lots of pressure off of us. And the interesting thing is, it doesn't mean that you decide, I don't want to come to church. It means you want to come more than you've ever wanted to come before. That's the interesting part. It's a different level of motivation. And for the first time in our lives, we're motivated from down here, inside, rather than somebody having to come constantly put a guilt trip on us. Rather than somebody constantly having to come and berate us to give more money and more time and more this and more that. It's all God's. Now, are we still going to have some struggle balancing our lives? Yes, we are. We are. But it's going to take the sharpness, the intensity off of that. Can you abuse this principle? Yeah, you can. If you want to, it's the same thing. Can you abuse grace? Sin may abound? Yep, you can. And if you want to, knock yourself out. Because you're going to be the one that's hurt by it. Can you abuse this concept of, well, hey, I worship all the time, so I don't have to come to church. It doesn't matter that much if I go to church. Can you abuse it? Yeah. If you want to, knock yourself out. You're going to be the one that's hurt. Unfortunately, your family's also going to be hurt. And the people at church, all the rest of us who need you as a part of this family here, we're going to be hurt. But that's your decision to make. And if somebody has it within their power to make you as an adult, I'm not talking about a child, but I'm talking about as an adult, and they force you to be here, and you don't want to be here, you're not doing yourself any good. And the odds may be you're not doing anybody else any good because you're sour and mad when you're here. This concept, this New Testament concept of worship, it brings me together as one whole person. And everything I do as unto the Lord. And I offer it to Him. And that means when I'm being unfairly treated, whenever the Lord tells young people to obey your parents in the Lord, to respect them. Are there some parents that are not respectable? Yes. But you know why you do it? You do it unto the Lord. It says, wives, submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. Not that He is your Lord, but you do that for the Lord's sake, as unto the Lord. Are there some husbands that don't deserve their wife to submit to them? Yes, there are. But you submit anyway. Why? Because you're doing it for the Lord. You're doing it for the Lord. And everything, whatever you do, in word or deed, what? Do it all unto the Lord. Everything. And so that puts a new level of motivation and incentive in your life. And it means that you can, somebody can mistreat you and you don't get mad and quit. Because you're doing it for the Lord anyway. It means that you can help somebody out who doesn't deserve it. Because you're doing it for the Lord anyway. And it means lots and lots of things in the motivation of our life. That it puts us on a completely new level. Now, we're going to have to get there. And it's going to take us some time. And we're going to look at some pretty technical things. We're going to go back and look at some Old Testament terminology and some New Testament terminology and see how it's used and to get us here. But let me ask you this. And by the way, we offer our lives, when we have this mindset, and when we're offering our bodies as living sacrifices, wholly acceptable to God. You remember what it says in the Old Testament about a sacrifice, a burnt sacrifice, that the odor went up as a sweet-smelling fragrance to the Lord? That's what your life becomes to God. It's a sweet-smelling fragrance to the Lord. Jesus lived something like 33 years. On this earth. Do you think that he lived 30 years of secular life and 3 years of spiritual life? He didn't. Neither do I. And neither do you. Do you think that he gave 12 hours to the Lord and 12 hours he worked in the carpenter shop and that wasn't unto the Lord? It was all unto the Lord. And folks, it makes a difference. We've robbed ourselves of the joy of consistency in our life and the real motivation in our life that keeps us going when nothing else will keep us going. Because I don't act and live and respond because other people treat me right or because people respond the way to me that they should. I live the way that I live, and I'm not trying to boast myself. I'm saying this is the way I'm trying to live. I live the way that I live because I believe that's the way the Lord wants me to live. And if that gets a response that is encouraging, that's great. If it gets a response that says, I'm going to kill you, that's great also. So be it. And when we know that we're secure, we're tight, me and the Lord, because of what he's done for me. And I'm giving him everything I got back to tell him how much I appreciate what he's done for me and how much I love him. Everything back. It's all his. We'll pick up there, Lord willing, next week. Thank you.